Good afternoon. I'm Larry Diamond, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. With Hoover Research Fellow Glenn Tifford, I lead the Hoover Institution project on China's global sharp power. We join with the Center on U.S.-China Relations at Asia Society, our co-sponsor today, in warmly welcoming you to this event with the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, David R. Stilwell, who is joining us from Tokyo today and will address the theme of today's session, Covert, Coercive, and Corrupt, Countering Chinese Communist Party Malign Influence in Free Societies. Following his address, he will engage in a conversation with two leading China scholars, Orville Schell and Oriana Mastro. But first, it's my pleasure to welcome, for opening remarks, the director of the Hoover Institution and the 66th Secretary of State of the United States, Condoleezza Rice.
I'm delighted to open this session of our project at Hoover on Chinese sharp power. And I especially want to welcome Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, David Stilwell. This project, I think, is one of the most important that we're engaged in because we face an extraordinary challenge with a rising China. Ever since Deng Xiaoping decided to bring China out of its isolation and presidents like Nixon and Carter followed up to get us into a position where we were actually in diplomatic relations with China, where we had recognized the People's Republic of China, where we had come eventually to a one China policy, continuing our obligations to Taiwan to help it defend itself, but really with an expectation that with this country of more than a billion people and economic potential that was potentially unknown in the history of the international system, there was really a decision that we had to integrate China. And that belief, that integrationist narrative, if you will, really dominated American foreign policy for four decades. There were expectations that this China integrated into the international system would be a net contributor. As my colleague Bob Selleck once called it, a responsible stakeholder. And indeed, there were some benefits to China's integration. Of course, 500 million people were lifted out of poverty. And of course, China did contribute to international economic growth, first by being the low-cost provider of labor, but also being a place where people could manufacture, where they could assemble. And so China was a contributor to the international economy. There were also hopes, though, that over time, China would be not just a responsible stakeholder, but a more liberal society. There were those who believed that China might go all the way to democracy, but even those who didn't see that as a possibility believed that the exposure to the international system, the exposure to the outside world would ultimately lead to governments in China that were more tolerant of their own people. That has not happened. And there was always a risk. There was always a risk that by having a closed society within an open international system, that closed society would eventually take advantage of the openness of that system. For so many years, that system had been dominated by democracies. Not every country within the international economy, as it emerged after World War II, was a democracy, but the most powerful countries were the United States, Great Britain, the countries of Europe, Japan. And so there was a harmony between the domestic politics and the domestic system and the checks and balances of democracy and the openness of the international system. For the first time, we have a very, very powerful state that has been admitted to that international economy, to that open system, and has remained and even become more authoritarian at home. And so the question before us is how to prevent this authoritarian regime from taking advantage of the benefits of openness, and indeed taking advantage of those countries that are democratic and open themselves. We have to understand how China is coercing. We have to understand how China is influencing. And we have to understand how China is using the benefits of the international economy and the open system to increase its military power so that its more assertive role in places like the South China Sea, and indeed in its aggressive behavior toward Taiwan, is actually using military power that has benefited from this connection to the open system. This isn't the Cold War. The Cold War was an ideological struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union was a military giant, but a technological midget. China is a technological giant and well on its way to becoming a military giant as well. And so this is an incredible challenge. It is a challenge, though, to our values, to be true to those values while not allowing ourselves to be taken advantage of. We do not want a situation in which innocent people, just because they are of Asian descent, are somehow held in suspicion, whether they are citizens or green card holders or visitors. We want to remain open to the world and to them, and we do not want them to feel intimidated in any way. We want our universities to be cognizant of what is going on in some of the programs that have been sponsored by China. We want the universities to be cognizant of what is going on in our frontier technologies labs in AI and quantum computing. We want our universities to be cognizant that there are those who, under the guise of a fellowship or a PhD program, might in fact be those who would go back and help the PLA to make Chinese military power even stronger. We want to be cognizant of that. But we also want to remain universities which are open. And we want to influence the next generation of Chinese students, because one day we have to hope that that belief that integration into the international system, openness to the world, will indeed have an impact on China too. First, we need to understand what we're facing. We need to understand all of the ways that China carries out policies of coercion or influence or increasing its military capability at our expense, using our knowledge. We need to understand the relationship between the Communist Party, the PLA, and research enterprises in China with whom we would then have relationships. We need to understand, too, our tools for dealing with it. And our tools are many. I believe free people will always triumph. But free people have to be cognizant, and they have to be aware of what is going on around them. Now, I want to say one other word about a truth telling, and that is this, that when we tell the truth, we are at our strongest. I'm a veteran of the old Cold War and the Soviet Union and the marvelous way in which at the end of the Cold War, it was clear that our values had triumphed. I'm often asked about some of the tools that we used in that time. And one that always comes up, because people are concerned about Chinese influence operations and Chinese efforts to cause dissension in our systems. And I'm always asked, well, what about Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, which obviously had a huge impact on the outcome of the Cold War? And I say the truth about Voice of America and Radio Free Europe is that they told the truth. They told the truth to a population that knew that their government was not telling them the truth. And so we need to use whatever tools we can to let it be known what China is doing, to let it be known in Africa, to let it be known in Europe, to let it be known to the degree that we can in Asia, and certainly to the degree that we can in China itself. Because ultimately, that is our best tool. Truth-telling. Openness. Again, I am very excited about this project because I think it does give us a chance to understand what we face and to design strategies to deal with it. I want to thank Larry Diamond and his colleagues in the China Sharp Power Project. Again, I want to welcome Assistant Secretary Stilwell. And I want to say to all of you watching out there, this is a battle we have to win. And we will. Thank you very much. It was great to be with you.
Thank you so much, Secretary Rice, for those inspirational remarks. Now it's my honor to introduce the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, David R. Stilwell. Before joining the State Department in this increasingly pivotal role, Assistant Secretary Stilwell had a distinguished 35-year career in the United States Air Force, retiring in 2015 in the rank of Brigadier General as the Asia Advisor to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. During his Air Force career, he served multiple tours of duty in Japan and Korea as a linguist, a fighter pilot, and a commander, and as defense attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing from 2011 to 2013. From 2017 to 2019, he served as director of the China Strategic Focus Group at the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command in Hawaii. In June 2019, he assumed the position of Assistant Secretary. In addition to his BS degree in history from the Air Force Academy, Assistant Secretary Stilwell also earned a master's degree in Asian Studies and Chinese Language from the University of Hawaii, and he was awarded in 2015 the Department of Defense Superior Service Award. Assistant Secretary Stilwell, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for the introduction and for the opportunity here to explain and elaborate on all we're doing here at the State Department. Hey, greetings from Tokyo. Being in the region is what I do. I'm happy to be here. And again, a good chance to work with Stanford and Hoover and Asia Society. Heroes like Larry Diamond, Orville Schell. Again, people I've long looked up to and studied and read and benefited from. And also, it's great to share a stage with Secretary Condoleezza Rice. Again, it's a real honor to be here. I really appreciate her summary. It tees up what I'm going to present here well, especially the part about truth-telling. You know, one of my goals in this job has been messaging, to tell our story better and to tell the truth. And it's ironic, but it's actually symptomatic that both the Soviet Union and the Chinese media outlets have the word truth in them, Pravda and Chosher, and yet the opposite is generally true. And so the topic of Chinese influence and corrupt, coercive, and covert activities is especially meaningful right now. And what you're seeing the administration doing, as I talk about this, hopefully it will be, it'll make sense, it'll be coherent. So the topic is the fact that the Chinese Communist Party challenges our free and open societies. And again, Secretary Rice made that point very clearly. But the prosperity, liberty, and security of the American people and our friends around the world are at risk. And it hinges on how we meet this challenge. To succeed, effort is required not just by policymakers and national security professionals, but by all elements of society, as Secretary Rice anticipated, I would say, and not just in America, but everywhere, which is, again, part of why we're trying to get the word out in these and other fora. A major worldwide defensive enterprise of this kind is difficult, but it's a noble undertaking. The foundation is a common threat assessment that the Chinese Communist Party is highly capable, it's ambitious, and it's also hostile to our basic political principles of democracy, openness, and individual dignity. It's important, first of all, that we recognize this challenge. I think we're there. The narrative has changed significantly over the last year. But it's also necessary that we give it the priority it deserves, despite many other pressing matters that inevitably demand our attention. So the Trump administration's 2017 national security strategy centered on the observation that we are in a geopolitical competition between free and repressive visions of world order. Secretary Pompeo says that China is the first challenge he thinks of every day when he wakes up. The Chinese Communist Party strategy implicates private as well as governmental targets around the world, which is why it is important for all institutions in our society, private and government, to understand the strategy and adapt measures to manage the risk, to counter coercion, and to protect free expression. The Hoover Institution has been exemplary in this area, including through its 2018 report on China's influence and American interests, promoting cognitive vigilance. So today I'm going to emphasize three points. First, influence and interference operations are fundamental to how the Chinese Communist Party engages with the world, and that's with all of us. We might prefer to think of China as simply a trade partner or the home of great civilization, but the CCP today has taken an adversarial stance toward its neighbors. Not just today, it's been a long-term process. We're recognizing it today. There also, this adversarial response touches on its immediate neighbors, contiguous, but and all other democratic and other societies like the US and the rest of the world. The goals are not stability or live and let live respect for the sovereignty of other law-abiding nations. Nope, the strategy is aggressive and it's intrusive. It not only rejects our democratic political principles, but it sees them as a prime vulnerability that it can't exploit. China's role in the world today cannot be understood without reference to the wide array of malign activities that the CCP undertakes to influence our societies in ways that are covert, coercive, and corrupting. We borrowed that language from John Garneau in Australia, who's been a leader in the Australian government, have led very well in this endeavor. So I want to give credit to the folks who coined that term. Second, the principle of reciprocity is vital to understanding this problem and in countering it. Reciprocity is basic in international relations. You got to give to get. You send your diplomats to my country and I'll send them to yours. I open my markets and you open your markets as well. Yet for decades, we and other countries made exceptions for China. But we allowed the Chinese Communist Party to engage with our societies on a non-reciprocal basis. And Beijing exploited the imbalance. And now our insistence on reciprocity is a long overdue defense. That was the second point. Third, coordination among allies and partners is imperative. This problem is global. In many ways, we and others around the world are still only waking up to the mass, the scale of this problem. We benefit from sharing information and ideas. Beijing prefers to exploit its size against individual countries in a bilateral fashion. It is often only by acting in concert that other countries can shift the calculus in favor of reciprocity, transparency, and freedom. And so we must do so. The bilateral aspect is noteworthy in that the narrative out of Beijing is often it's the US versus China. And we've been working very hard to shift that. It's not just us. It's many other like-mindeds. The drumbeat, especially coming out of EU lately, is impressive. So a lot of this hinges on the whole concept of the United Front, United Front Work Department. The world is increasingly aware of how the CCP is using its foreign engagements to influence, interfere, and coerce. The awareness is disturbing and even shocking for many people because for decades, the U.S. and other countries forged links with China based on the optimistic good faith expectation that shared prosperity and trust would result from our diplomacy, our trade, and our investment. It worked so many times in the past. We've had media and academic and people-to-people exchanges also falling under that same assumption. But the sad and dangerous reality is that the CCP has chosen to weaponize these engagements to its advantage, and it uses them as channels for malign purposes, again, primarily to maintain its position and to advance its position, to accelerate its growth and development. Beijing officials claim to seek, quote, win-win exchanges. They claim to practice non-interference in other countries' affairs. And this is an important point. The irony of this insistence on non-interference and the five principles of peaceful engagement is interesting when you see the totality of this activity. And I think we should shine, to quote John Garneau, some sunlight on this. In reality, the conduct is systematically predatory and hegemonic. The CCP wants control, and at least it wants a veto in public discourse and political decisions globally, world over. So this is what guides its foreign interference activities, these activities that China calls United Front Work, and we better understand this political warfare. Xi Jinping calls the United Front a magic weapon of the Chinese Communist Party, and Mao Zedong saw it the same way. So how does it work? I'll give you a couple visible examples that, again, once we are awake to the problem, become unbelievably obvious. United Front interference in Australia has produced years of cascading news headlines. An up-and-coming senator was forced to resign over improper ties to the Chinese Beijing-linked donor. Numerous senior officials retired into jobs with entities controlled by Beijing. Advertising boycotts were organized against Chinese language newspapers that won't toe Beijing's line. An intelligence chief warned of the catastrophic harm Australia is subject to as a result of espionage, interference, sabotage, and malicious insider activities. At the University of Queensland last year, students demonstrating for Hong Kong's democratic rights were roughed up by classmates connected to a Beijing-sponsored students association. The PRC Consul General praised the spontaneous patriotic behavior of the pro-Beijing rallies. Australia's defense minister then warned foreign diplomats not to suppress Australia's free speech. New Zealand has had similar experiences. After university campus skirmishes over Hong Kong, local PRC diplomats praised the spontaneous patriotism of the anti-democracy brawlers. In response, New Zealand's prime minister asked officials to remind their Chinese counterparts that New Zealand will uphold and maintain our freedom of expression. And oftentimes this is a fairly simple solution, is just stand up, recognize the problem, and say something. And there'll be threats that come from that, but we've seen those threats are very rarely carried out. In 2017, New Zealand media revealed that a Chinese-born member of the parliament had lied about his background when applying for New Zealand citizenship, concealing that he had spent 15 years working for the Chinese military intelligence. The parliamentarian, who had previously played a prominent role in bilateral relations with Beijing, lost his seat on the Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade Committees, but remained in the parliament. Co-opting friends and neutralizing enemies are two sides of United Front coin. In Australia and in New Zealand, scholars critical of Beijing have faced burglaries and death threats. In suburbs from New South Wales to New Jersey, Chinese dissidents and activists are hounded by Chinese Communist Party agents. You've heard about Fox Hunt and other things. United Front targets not just people, but also information, including private data about large numbers of public and private individuals. In the United States and across the world, we see systematic theft on a huge scale of intellectual property and technology from universities, businesses, medical labs, most recently. At the United Nations and in capitals around the world, the CCP agents are behind bribery scandals. Beijing's overseas infrastructure projects often go hand in hand with bribes for local elites and really harsh financing terms hidden in secret contracts with non-disclosure agreements. Aggressive United Front propaganda work then dishonestly portrays the arrangements as benevolent rather than rapacious. The CCP is increasing its propaganda on television and in newspapers worldwide, while at the same time undermining independent Chinese language media wherever it is found. Pop culture, arts, and sports are major battlegrounds too. American saw the National Basketball Association thrown into crisis over a single tweet about Hong Kong. Players, coaches, and owners known for strong opinions are cowed into silence when the topic is China. Fans are booed from stadiums for holding signs that say Google Uyghurs or flying a Tibet flag. And it's amazing that we haven't said more about this to date. We see the conspicuous absence of Hollywood movies willing to depict China critically or to portray the heroism of young people of Hong Kong, the leaders of underground Chinese Christian churches, or Tibetans just trying to preserve their culture. There's also an increasing number of Hollywood movies portraying Beijing as a benevolent global leader, even in areas such as space, where in fact Beijing very recklessly carried out a anti-satellite missile test back in 2007, littering low Earth orbit with a lot of space junk. So we see the bullying of corporations, Marriott, Mercedes-Benz, and many more to parrot CCP talking points lest they face state-backed boycotts, undermining and impacting their bottom line. Business executives are enticed to toe Beijing's line lest long-promised access to the Chinese market be cut short, curtailed, or not materialize. Meanwhile, we've got COVID-19 disinformation, we have PPE shakedowns globally, and wolf warrior diplomacy. All these things are especially recently telling examples of all the things I'm describing. So all these manifestations of United Front work, they subvert interests and principles that we all cherish. They all reflect the intertwined dangers of this coercive, covert, and corrupting influence. And so we describe this of late as an iceberg. What we see of this, what I call fuzzy panda activity, is what's above the waterline. But there is so much below the waterline that we have either ignored or just simply not recognized. And so, again, my goal today and all along has been just to point out facts, right? Seek truth through facts. Beijing's instruments for exerting this influence are enormous. In recent years, Xi Jinping has added 40,000 cadre to the United Front Work Department, making it four times the size of the State Department's Foreign Service Corps. And that doesn't even count the other parts of the Beijing party state that play a role in shaping foreign opinion and foreign governments to Beijing's liking. These include the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Central Propaganda Department, the Ministry of State Security, the Ministry of Education, the International Liaison Department, the Political Work Department, the Central Propaganda Bureau, and the People's Liberation Army. These entities, in turn, guide a plethora of official, quasi-official, and front organizations that operate around the world, often and through diaspora communities. Some of these United Front organizations identify as Beijing-backed, but most try to present themselves as independent grassroots-type NGOs or cultural exchange for friendship associations. You'll hear that word a lot. When you hear United Front, you'll see the word friendship. Chambers of commerce, media outlets, or academic groups. Then there are Confucius Institutes at colleges and universities, and more disturbing is Confucius classrooms at the K-12 level. These are funded by Beijing and play by Beijing's rules. They were launched in 2004 by no less than the head of the United Front Work Department, Liu Yandong. In 2009, Politburo Standing Committee member and ideology czar Li Changchun called Confucius Institutes an important part of Chinese overseas propaganda setup. All told, we face a large and deliberately opaque amalgam of Chinese Communist Party officials, agents, and cutouts seeking advantage in our societies. And that advantage is readily had because, as the Secretary Rice said, we pride ourselves in being open and easily accessible. And so think in terms of this iceberg. Above the waterline official PRC diplomats conducting legitimate diplomatic activities, for example. But below the waterline, there is a far larger and murkier mix of actions and entities whose ties to the Communist Party have been long ignored, overlooked, or understudied. These include PRC diplomats conducting activities inconsistent with their diplomatic status, such as the espionage tied to the PRC consulate in Houston before we shuttered it this summer. PRC state media personnel masquerade as legitimate news reporters when their real business is propaganda and espionage. I ask you to show me a byline by any number, any one of these many, supposed reporters. Researchers sent by the PLA into our high-tech university labs, especially those who illegally hide their military affiliation on their visa applications. The iceberg further includes Confucius Institutes, Confucius Classrooms, and the Chinese Students and Scholars Associations that chill academic freedom and free speech in our schools and universities. Also, United Front organizations working to co-opt state and local governments, diaspora communities, and other targets. And don't forget China's state-owned enterprises, which aren't just owned on paper by Beijing, but can be used by Beijing at Beijing's will as instruments in this battle of policies and narratives. There are also PLA-owned enterprises, of which there are many operating in this country and around the world. And even private Chinese firms, which just last month received aggressive new guidance from Beijing to follow Communist Party diktats and support United Front work. You saw the fifth plenary just wrapped up and it reemphasized these points. So this iceberg deserves a serious study and scrutiny. Across our society and across the world, we must better track, expose, and when necessary, counter these vectors of influence and interference. That is why the State Department has taken steps recently under the Foreign Missions Act to identify organizations operating in the United States under the control of the Communist Party by designating them as foreign missions of the People's Republic of China. It's just a fact. It's not a judgment. They do work for the directly for the government, therefore they qualify. We have so far designated 15 state propaganda outlets and the Confucius Institute Center of the United States and the National Association for China's Peaceful Reunification this week, a key United Front group. Similarly, the Pentagon this year, for the first time, identified dozens of companies operating in the United States that are owned by or affiliated with the People's Liberation Army. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is pursuing a wide range of law enforcement actions against covert, coercive, and corrupting activity. This includes alleged visa fraud by PLA researchers in U.S. universities, economic espionage by corporate executives, Ministry of State security agents, and others, drug trafficking, money laundering, and more. Just this week, the Department of Justice charged 8 individuals with acting as illegal agents of Beijing to harass, stalk, and coerce U.S. residents, forcing them to return to Beijing against their will. And so without greater transparency, reciprocity, and cost, Beijing will continue to exploit this openness of our societies and advance their interests at our expense. We just want a level playing field. We'd like reciprocity. Treat us that way, we're going to have to take similar measures. So let's dwell for a moment on reciprocity. President Trump said repeatedly that reciprocity is his favorite word, and mine too. It is an especially useful concept when applied to China because reciprocity and the lack thereof captures so much about the troubled and imbalanced relations that countries all around the world have found themselves in with Beijing. And reciprocity doesn't fix everything. It doesn't have to guide our interactions in all cases, everywhere and always. But it is a basic guide to fairness, prudence, and caution, attributes that the world generally discarded during years of reckless engagement with Beijing, 40 years of trying hard without any real response. We allowed the Chinese Communist Party to access our society that it never extended to us. Diplomatic access, educational access, trade access, NGOs, 3-4 years ago, no longer they have to be sponsored by the PRC, investment access, science and technology access, even data access. We thought it was worth it, that it wouldn't cost as much. that it would aid China's development and crucially facilitate Beijing's political transformation into a responsible and friendly regime. As you know, the result of all this, though, is quite different. So access to our societies, our economies, and our technologies certainly helped China develop, but the Chinese Communist Party only doubled down on Leninism, mercantilism, and hostility to the West. Now we scramble late, but not too late, to protect our own societies from being transformed by Beijing. And so reviving this idea of reciprocity, give to get, is a absolutely fundamental and principled step. So there's no reason why Beijing's diplomats should be able to enjoy open access to American society, while the folks that I work with in Beijing and those of us who've been there are prevented from even the simplest of interaction with society, travel, and many other typical normal diplomatic activities. Visiting universities is nigh to impossible right now, and other interaction just is very difficult. And even if they don't make us, if they don't stop us from interacting, the people that we talk to are then harassed. That's just not fair. There's no reason why Beijing state media propagandists should be treated as independent journalists in our country, while Beijing further restricts the few Americans remaining in China and other independent foreign journalists left there. There's no reason why Beijing state enterprises, military affiliated companies, and their technology national champions should enjoy every privilege of the American economy, while Beijing denies market access to a large share of American firms, and it certainly doesn't host major enterprises that serve our military. So in these areas and more, we are taking policy, regulatory, and law enforcement action across the U.S. government to correct years of non-reciprocity, imbalance, and abuse. It works inside the U.S., but again, to be effective, it's going to have to be global. It's going to have to, there's an international aspect that's really important. As Secretary Pompeo has said, we encourage every leader of every nation to start by doing what America has done. Just simply insist on fair, equal treatment and reciprocity. Insist on transparency. Insist on accountability from the CCP. Among the propaganda narratives promoted by the United Front is the notion that any scrutiny of the Communist Party activities is somehow a hostile act against Beijing or against the Chinese people. We talk about the party. You hear that. We don't allow them to conflate that with 1.4 billion people. All sorts of businesses and organizations know well how to do risk management, how to do due diligence, and how did you understand knowing your client? It's long past due that we start systematically applying similar approaches to our engagement with China and the Chinese Communist Party. Indeed, one reason why is that under Xi Jinping, it's just become effectively impossible to engage China without interacting with the party. Things have changed over the last 7 years. We encourage countries to study your own icebergs, take stock of your own policy toolkits. Examples, do you have laws like our Foreign Mission Act as our Foreign Agent Registration Act? If not, do you need them? You know, since 1991, we've assumed that the threat has decreased. Well, we know now that it's not, the threat is there. What about a China initiative like that of our Justice Department? The sorts of espionage, theft, corruption, visa fraud, coercion, and other abuses being uncovered by our law enforcement investigations, they exist wherever the Chinese Communist Party operates. It's not confined to the U.S. Australia, seeing a few years ago that its laws and government structure were lacking in certain key areas, passed a landmark series of bills on countering foreign influence. Australia helped teach the world how to organize against this threat and how to think and speak about it. As Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said, "We will not tolerate foreign influence activities that are covert, coercive, or corrupt." That is the line that separate legitimate influence from unacceptable interference. So let's learn from each other and let's coordinate, not only to compare notes, but also to establish deterrence. Despite the magnitude of the challenge, we have massive leverage, especially as a group. Chinese Communist Party wants access to what other countries have. Lucrative markets and capital, advanced technologies, world-class universities and laboratories, international prestige. We must no longer give these away to Beijing easily in hopes that the CCP will respond to our goodwill and kind. Its record shows that it won't. Transparency, reciprocity, fairness, accountability, rule of law. The golden rule, right? Treat others as you'd like to be treated. These are necessary guides if we are to prevent the CCP from continuing to assault our societies from within. As we posture for this challenge, it is also important to underscore that our concern is not with the Chinese people, as I just said, who we admire greatly, but with the policies of the Chinese Communist Party. Precise language and strategy are vital. The CCP tries to make itself synonymous with the Chinese people and civilization, but it certainly is not. It also tries to equate criticism of the party with criticism of the people. We must be clear in rejecting this, and it's showing that our free and open societies value the very ethnic, cultural, and political diversity that the CCP seeks to crush. And just look at the facts, right? Seek truth through facts. Look at how things are in this country, free world, and then look at how they are in China. And the obvious, the differences are glaring. And so the stakes. Why is it essential that free nations of the world exercise vigilance over the growing iceberg of worldwide CCP influence? Simply put, the Leninist Politburo that runs China wants to set the rules for the rest of the world. It has to. It needs it. You know, the existence of free and open democratic societies is an inherent threat. So a future Pax Sinica fully realized would be aggressive, would be contemptuous of human liberty and domineering. Instead of a rules-based international order, peaceful resolution of disputes, respect for sovereignty of law-abiding nations, a CCP-oriented world would require obedience to an unelected clique in Beijing. Technological advances in surveillance and control risk casting the entire world into an age of tyranny. Ask the booksellers of Hong Kong for proof. Ask Jimmy Lai. Ask His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Ask Ai Weiwei or Liu Xia, the widow of Liu Xiaobo. Ask the Uyghurs. Ask the brave citizens of Taiwan. Ask any neighboring state with China. The Chinese Communist Party poses a real risk to our basic way of life, to prosperity, security, and liberty. Our task is to recognize, alert others, and then take necessary steps to defend our hard-earned freedoms. They must be defended. Thanks. And with that, I look forward to conversation.
I want to really issue a deep and heartfelt thanks to Assistant Secretary Stilwell. You mentioned the oft-quoted phrase from Prime Minister Turnbull and John Garneau, covert, coercive, and corrupting. I would offer another three C's to characterize your remarks, cogent, comprehensive, and compelling. This is, I think, the best 25-minute characterization of where we're at and where we must go that I've heard. And thank you for mentioning, Mr. Assistant Secretary, our Hoover Asia Society report on China's influence and American interests toward toward constructive vigilance. This was a report that we produced in collaboration with our next speaker, Orville Schell, the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at Asia Society, which is again the co-sponsor of this event. He is the author of 10 books about China, including most recently, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. And he organized with me the Asia Society Hoover Institution Working Group that produced that report. He'll make some observations, perhaps pose a question or two, and then we'll hear from our newest colleague at Stanford University specializing in China, Oriana Scholar Mastro, She recently joined Stanford as a center fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where her research focuses on Chinese military and security policy, Asia-Pacific security issues, war termination, and coercive diplomacy. Dr. Mastro is also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institutes and serves in the United States Air Force Reserve, for which she works as a strategic planner at INDOPACOM. So we're really doubling down on the U.S. Air Force today, very proudly. Orville, we turn to you first.
Well, thank you, Larry. And thank you for your very comprehensive speech, Assistant Secretary Stilwell. I really don't want to make lengthy remarks myself, except to say I do believe we are at something of a transition moment, when all of the assumptions and policies of the past do beg our reflection and reformulation. I think we are truly beginning to see China in a very different light, partially because it has become stronger and more influential. Let me ask you this. You've just been on a rather epic trip that's taken the Secretary of State to the Maldives, to India, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Vietnam, and now you yourself are in Tokyo. And I wonder, you've limned a pretty, dark picture about what it is that we confront from China, not just militarily, not just in terms of trade, but in terms of this sort of this united front policy and influence seeking. How have you found these countries you've just visited in terms of the way they are reappraising their own attitudes towards China? And what do you think that bears for this idea of the Quad, which started off as pretty much just an idea, but now seems to be getting fleshed out with some more real substance. So talk a little bit about your trip and how it's changed your views of what partners, allies, and friends, of how they're looking at the People's Republic of China.
Sure, that's a great point. Some shameless advertising, one of my favorite books. I know it's one of the early ones, but I still reference it. A lot of what's in there is cogent today. So travel, it's the best part of diplomacy, I think, is actually going to see people where they are. I was in Japan 3 weeks ago during the Quad. I got to witness the merging of an agreement on the issue, and not just the issue itself, not just admiring the problem, but the solution. And just the coming together. I mentioned this position out of Beijing that says, this is the U.S. hostile policy, trying to make this bilateral. And you know, the Quad, the recent travel statements out of the stops we made that you described, increasingly align. And, you know, this helps the message, and it helps Beijing understand that it needs to change course. It needs to simply comply with the system that exists. It's a functioning system. It's existed and functioned for 70 years quite well. It wants to change that system to accommodate its own Leninist perspective on the world. But I do think that there is, through multiple voices, through a chorus of voices, there is an opportunity here to just simply get the CCP to slow down and to, again, abide by the rules that it, over years that it convinced us it was going to do. That was the hard part, was acknowledging that what it was saying wasn't kosher. It wasn't quite right. It was deception. I'll address your question here specifically in 1 second, though. But again, I'll point out one of the areas we've been focused on is media. I mentioned Wolf Warrior Diplomacy, MFA spokesman saying things. If you just take a hard look at anything they say, it's just a model of disinformation. And I use the term, interference, and you juxtapose that with the theme that we keep hearing is non-interference in internal affairs. And then you look at the facts in Australia, again, Turnbull and Garneau were the first to actually shine some sunlight on that. Just look at the reality of it. And there's always this propaganda, disinformation aspect to it, that when, if you just consider what is being said and think about it and use critical thought, apply, you know, free thought, which is things that we pride ourselves in, the disinformation becomes very visible. As far as the trip, it represents quite well that what we mean by the Indo-Pacific strategy. In the past, EAP, East Asia Pacific Bureau, never, I don't want to overstate it. I don't want to offend anybody. But the EAP responsibility and the South Central Asia responsibility and approaches didn't always align. And so I hired my deputy, Atul Keshap. He is a South Central Asia expert. And one of my goals and one of the things you should take out of this trip is that this trip exemplifies what we mean by the Indo-Pacific strategy. It is a coherent whole. And this is why we changed the name in 2017, Indo-PACOM, and all the rest. So they are still of varying stridency. The narrative coming out of India, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Indonesia, and Vietnam aren't all the same. The volume isn't all the same. And that's you know, expected. And I think you can attribute that to sheer size and heft. Some, like the US and Australia, feel they can afford economically to stand up and be counted. We believe this gives space to countries like Indonesia and Vietnam, who, with the July change in the US South China Sea policy, acknowledging the 2016 tribunal outcomes, and the debunking Chinese maritime claims, Indonesia and Vietnam and others have been able to now exert their proper use of their economic zones and the rest. Sorry for the wandering response. I'd be happy to be cross-examined on that. I will note that it is 4:50 in the morning here. So
give us 15 seconds on the trend line that you discern, having been to all of these countries. What direction are they heading?
Well, I believe, given all that we just laid out, I think that trend is very positive. I don't expect them to do everything they can in many cases, but just simply being transparent about what is going on in their countries by simply examining what's going on in their countries. In fact, they were in the past they were deterred from doing that. Just don't look there. The one thing that we have to address further, and this is the idea of sunlight, is going after the corrupting aspects of this strategy. Because if you buy off the elites, and if the people don't have visibility on that, or if they're being told they can't comment on that, then this strategy by the United Front works. It depends entirely on, co-opting leadership. And so part of this, and the reason we focus on media so much, is enabling, empowering me to research and investigate.
Great. I'd like to come now to Dr. Oriana Schuyler-Mastro, and we welcome your observations and questions for the Assistant Secretary.
Good morning. Thank you, Larry. And I apologize to the viewers for my romantic lighting over here. I think Assistant Secretary Stilwell is up a little bit earlier than I am. I am in Sydney, Australia, and unfortunately in an apartment where natural light lights the whole place. So we don't have the sun yet, but hopefully you can still see me. Assistant Secretary Stilwell, it's great to see you and have you here at Hoover. I wanted to ask you a bit about how to decipher or differentiate between sort of legitimate, illegitimate activities. And in some cases, you didn't use these terms, but people often use inappropriate and appropriate. So given, obviously I'm here in my civilian capacity, but given my military background, I feel like I am much more clear-eyed about some of the threats that you have mentioned. And I'm very happy that you have discussed them. And I think in the university setting in particular, there can be a bit of a naivete about what the goals are of some of these engagement efforts. And so I really applaud the desire to bring that truth and to bring that knowledge more broadly. Given that you're a China specialist, what I want to sort of ask you is to put on the China hat, because one of my main concerns is how acceptable or open other countries are to this narrative that you're presenting. So sort of two specific questions. The first is this legitimate, illegitimate, appropriate, inappropriate. We say it's very clear from our perspective, but I wonder if for some of our viewers, it's less clear why Voice of America is okay. And you know, the insert to the Washington Post or something would not be okay, or the difference between Confucius Institutes and Alliance Française, for example. Now you mentioned, you know, there's a difference between covert activities. So I'm wondering if like a PLA scholar did put on their application, their visa application, that they were PLA, or then are we open to them coming? Because to a certain degree, people, even I, when I go to China, I gain information and I want to bring it back to the betterment of my country, right? So where do we draw the line on some of these things? And I wonder, you know, how much, if you put on your China hat, what would they say to everything you just said? And I can imagine some of the counters, things like, you know, the United States has tried regime change 74 times between 1947 and 1991. You know, isn't foreign military interference worse than some of these political interference? Isn't what they're doing just basically, you know, politics to a certain degree? So I'm wondering if you can just sort of specify a bit more on, of course, China's going to seek influence, but, you know, how are they going to seek influence? What would you want to see them do as they seek influence? And along those lines, you mentioned reciprocity. And as you know, there's no Chinese word for reciprocity, right? The Chinese word that they use is like mutual benefit. And so how do you think some of these different views about reciprocity might actually impact our ability to get them? You say to give is to get. That's different than to give the same thing and get the same thing. Should we continue to scale it based on, you know, what China can give us? And so I'll leave it there, and I look forward to your thought.
We've wrestled with those quite a bit. Exactly what's appropriate and what's not. And I don't think I can give you a yardstick for what that looks like. But I would say, again, going back to the idea of reciprocity, is that if you're going to do these things in my country, then I should be able to do those in yours, right? They will always say, I mean, when I confronted them about why, when I was a defense attaché, I could not call my counterpart. I could not call my counterpart directly, while the Chinese defense attaché in the U.S., had every phone number in DOD and set up meetings on a regular basis. I asked him, why is it that I can't do that? And his answer was a smug, because that's not our system. So your point is exactly right, is it is a bit of apples and oranges. You know, their system is different, their culture is different. But look, we interact with 190 something other countries on this planet without this same, you know, there are ways of coming to agreements on these things that gets us the balance in the relationship that we seek. I don't think anybody would argue right now that the relationship between China and the rest of the world is in balance. You know, the diplomatic corps in Beijing, when I was there, all agreed it was very difficult to operate, and it was getting more and more difficult to operate there compared to what they were giving their Chinese counterparts in their specific countries. So there's a couple of examples that we gave. You mentioned the military. This is an area where transparency and greater interaction is increasingly necessary. And yet what we're seeing here is the ability to actually communicate with the Chinese government is getting more difficult. And so it's not just nice to have. This interaction, this reciprocal access is incredibly and increasingly important to make sure that the messages are crystal clear, that there are no wupan wujie, you know, misunderstandings and miscalculations that they often talk about. So in the military space, they call the relationship the ballast and the rudder of the relationship. I really hope that they begin to act on that, and you know, instead of closing down, that they act more openly. There's many other aspects I could talk about, since we're speaking in academia here, I'll also note that I think it's more difficult for academics and for schools to insist on, you know, reciprocity, since you don't often go to China to talk to their students and scholars, although I know you do, but it's not so formal then I would just simply look at what the example they set in the country is, and either ask them to abide by those same rules in the US or insist on opening up access. There was a few folks came out the East-West Center when I was living in Hawaii, who, you know, in 2015 and 16 were noting the impressive and rapid clampdown on conversations inside China. And then you quickly saw that clampdown happening outside, where conversations were being squashed because they might be uncomfortable, might be talking about the Dalai Lama and other things that they don't like. On that, Oriana, I would just say, you know, be who you are. Universities, you insist on academic freedom and academic integrity, insist on it. Remember Cambridge University Press a couple of years ago took down 250 articles the CCP deemed inappropriate. And then they reversed that decision, which was very encouraging. You know, you have to think about those things. That's a wandering, would you like to redirect or cross-examine?
No, Sarah, I'm good. Thank you. I do think there's a lot of work to be done to understand actually the details of these activities. And I think you're right that what they do in universities is different than versus the government, which is different in the media versus NGOs. And so, you know, we need to figure out how to prioritize what are the most dangerous activities and which ones we should address first, last, and how we should address them.
Great. I'd like to call on my colleague in the China Global Sharp Power Project at the Hoover Institution, who also, Mr. Assistant Secretary, just co-edited a very important study, Global Engagement, Rethinking Risk in the Research Enterprise, which very much addresses the challenge you posed of PLA scientists, engineers, and so on at the so-called Seven Sons of National Defense universities, not disclosing their ties and then coming here and collaborating on research projects and being visiting scholars. So Dr. Glenn Tiffert, would you like to pose a question?
Thank you very much, Larry, and thank you, Assistant Secretary Stilwell, for joining us today. I wanted to pull together a couple of threads that others have raised and not talk specifically about the academic issue, but talk about security cooperation and broader alignments. We're starting to see greater coordination and alignment among democracies in the Indo-Pacific as they face the challenges posed by China's more assertive posture in the region. For instance, Secretaries Pompeo and Esper just concluded a productive round of 2+2 meetings in India that resulted in the BECA agreement, and India just invited Australia to join its Malabar naval exercises later this year. The reinvigorated Quad, composed of Japan, India, Australia, and the US, is one of the most promising platforms for a collective multilateral response to China, but opinions differ on how far its constituent members are willing to take it. In light of the United States' national security and national defense strategies, could you articulate the vision that the United States has for what the Quad could accomplish and how you'd like to see it develop? Thank you.
That's a great question. And since you mentioned national security strategy, I'm a simple guy. You know, I was a heavy equipment operator in the Air Force for 35 years. And I do know that getting too complex and complicated makes frequently just defeats whatever you're trying to accomplish. So let's just go in simple terms. The National Security Strategy, H.R. McMaster, wonderfully, I can talk about that. There's a good story in there. Noted that this is a strategic competition. We've never actually said that before. You know, the first step in any problem solving is acknowledging that there is a problem. And so by noting strategic competition, we then give latitude and voice to people in the country to actually stand up and compete. What you saw then from the PRC was a very shrill, the sky is falling, you know, the hostile American policy. And I just remind them whenever I can that internally they refer to the US and others as the enemy. And they've always done that consistently. So I guess the first step in all of this is just acknowledging the problem and then making your words align with the reality. Euphemisms don't help. We need to speak clearly And again, these are simple solutions to the larger problem. Relating the NSS, national security, and the competition aspect to the Quad, again, for a one-bit processor, they are self-evident. I don't have to restate how many times in my short interaction with India, since I started the Pentagon in 2013 till now, that you've seen a very confrontational relationship in an area of a contiguous border. And then that relationship with Pakistan, Chinese Pakistan cooperation also puts India on notice. I would note in the Quad that it is not one, it's not directed by the US. It really is a 4-point consensus-based and sort of naturally occurring outcome of democracies who see the threat and want to stand up to that threat. Again, in my past experience, the US often, one person said, when we show up at ASEAN or when we show up in Southeast Asia, we don't make problems better or worse, we just add energy to the issues. I think we've gotten better at maybe showing up and listening more rather than just, you know, showing up in the room with three other partners in the Quad and dictating terms. And if you saw the opening statements for the Quad in Tokyo 3 weeks ago, you heard the same story from all four partners, is that look, we want to acknowledge the issue, the problem, and then we want to protect our own interests. We want to protect our own systems. We don't want to have our systems adapted or amended or just outright changed by a authoritarian government. So in short, what I'll tell you is the Quad is obviously visible. It's increasingly productive, but it's organic. It's naturally occurring. It's just a obvious response to a rapidly accelerating and aggressive PRC strategy.
Great. Well, we have only about 10 or so minutes left. Mr. Assistant Secretary, I'd like to get to a couple of audience questions at least. Let me begin by taking off on India. This was the first stop of Secretary Pompeo's 5-day visit to Asia. I don't know if you were with him on that leg. But we did sign a new basic exchange and cooperation agreement with India. Ties between India and the US with concern about China seem to be deepening. There was a question about that agreement. It's got some implications for Air Force to Air Force cooperation, so you might have a thought about that. Is there anything more you want to say about that visit, that agreement, and that relationship?
As you know, I was there. It was a great trip. I had my own meetings with China watchers in India, in Delhi, in New Delhi. So I can't speak to the exact outcomes of the 2+2 conversation. But the fact that we had that conversation and the fact that there were tangible outcomes output to me speaks volumes. And I think that's about all I can talk about. I can't talk about the details on information sharing. I will note, though, that as Oriana knows, that you need systems that can talk to each other in this age. Even if you're doing something as simple as humanitarian relief, disaster assistance, in an information age, military cooperation is driven largely by information. And so the more we can move things like information agreements and all those, the better off we'll be able to respond to these things.
Great. As I mentioned, we've just finished 6 sessions focusing on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. The lengthening shadow of the Communist Chinese Party state and its oft-declared ambition, in its words, to reunify Taiwan with the motherland. Taiwan, of course, and its friends have a very different view about that language and that relationship hangs like a dark shadow over all our conversations now. What can you say about the challenge of preserving Taiwan's democracy and its right to be a free society in the wake of this seemingly accentuating resolve in Beijing to possibly address this situation by means that are covert, coercive, and corrupting, or just plain coercive? What assurances would you want to give to the people of Taiwan and its friends? And how do you see that challenge in the wake of what Beijing has done to the people of Hong Kong?
We could probably talk for hours. That should be a topic you host for the next event. It's a really important subject. I give a speech, by the way, most of the stuff I do, almost all of it, other than this free talking, is done by others, smarter people than me. And so I always want to give credit to the Fifes and the Keshups and the others in this world. But there's a speech this time last year on 40 years of trying. 40 years of giving, a little bit to the PRC in order, in exchange for consideration on issues that we consider important, and the realization after 40 years that they never intended to give back. You saw this summer, I gave a presentation at another think tank on the six assurances that were recently declassified. And the reason we're doing this is to go back to the original agreements from 1979, 1982, where we did agree with the PRC that, we would recognize them, or we have a one-China policy and all those things, but that the question of Taiwan would be resolved peacefully without coercion or use or threat of use of force. And what we've seen over time, and part of this, there was another document declassified August 17th, 1982, where the Reagan administration noted that, although we want to trust the PRC, we should trust but verify, famously, and that if, arms numbers on the weapon sales would go down, but the opposite happened, therefore there was an acknowledgement that we might have to continue arms sales to make sure that the balance across the strait gives Taiwan the ability to negotiate without coercion or use of force. What has happened over the years, look at WHA recently, World Health Assembly, where Taiwan was able to participate freely through 2017, and it was excluded and excluded again this session, even though they've got lots and lots to offer. Our policy hasn't changed. We're just going to insist on it, vice allowing it to be whittled away and eroded. And again, you'll hear the Beijing gets very uncomfortable with this, but I will just reassure that there is no intention to somehow expand. We just want to get back to a place where Taiwan can deal with the mainland from a position of so we can negotiate the solution by having it dictated to them.
Great. We've got just a few minutes left. I want to ask Orville Schell and Oriana Mastro if they have any brief additional questions. Maybe I'll give you each a minute, and the final words will go to the Assistant Secretary. Orville?
I'm curious to know how you look back on the period of engagement. Was it a mistake? Were we deluded? Were we just unapprised of the of China's intentions, or was it a smart move to try to shepherd China out of its revolutionary past? And then, what part of engagement should we still cling to, even in this period of adversity?
So that is the question. And that speech last year. 40 years of trying, and nowhere in there do you hear me criticize the last 40 years. We had to try, right? And it worked in the past, and we've seen peaceful transitions. I mean, look at the Republic of Korea. This activity, this sort of engagement brought Korea out of, when I was there in 1980, a dictatorship, and it moved it into a strong, vibrant democracy. So you had to try. But there is a point where you have to acknowledge, and I came to this conclusion in 2011 when I showed up in Beijing, that it's not going the right way. We should be very proud of the patience we've demonstrated, but we should also be insistent on making sure that China lives up to its many agreements. And it's not doing that. And so we have to go a more firm stance. I think I'll leave it at that. We definitely had to try, and we're just going to take a more firm line now.
Mm-hmm. Oriana?
Yes, thank you. So now, sir, we're in a great power competition with China, and I'm very happy to see that kind of formulation. As you know, China has been competing with us since its founding. So it's good that we've kind of woken up to that. I won't ask you what victory looks like, because I think this is a long-term, potentially sort of perpetuating state. So I'll ask instead, what does winning look like? You know, how do we know that we are out competing China, or, you know, that we're doing well? And what are some of the sectors, areas, or indicators that you're looking to that for you are the most important, that you'll be the most proud of if we actually reach certain goals?
Wow. It's like it was planned. That's my getting off stage. This will be my closing points. That's fantastic. What does victory look like? I would refer you to the secretary's speech at the Nixon Library. I think that gets to much of the point, and he said it far better than I did. I will point to the secretary's very vigorous approach to speaking out. That's victory. The fact that people, not just the U.S. anymore, and it's not just Secretary Pompeo or the president, people globally are speaking out. The Czechia trip to Taiwan, 90 member delegation, without fear of the reprisals that come from that. That's victory. The Germans inviting Taiwan to the Bundestag is another victory. The WTO, the World Bank, taking a harder look at Chinese state-owned enterprises and whether or not they should be included in contracts. The China Communication Construction Company and others that we recently designated as SOEs. All these things are victory. Call me Pollyanna, say I'm overly optimistic, or maybe I'm too close to this subject because, you know, we're right here. But my assessment is that we are on the way to an accommodation, some sort of a balance between a free and open democratic world and a system in the PRC that doesn't appreciate that. But the longer these two systems are in competition, the more obvious the right answer will be. The same answer we came to in 1991. Hopeful that, like we mentioned before, that 4 years of engagement might actually help this system morph into something that's, you know, less confrontational, something that appreciates fair trade and free access and real competition. I think we can get there. I'm hopeful that we can. And then I'll point to this forum where it's not just Dave Stilwell, EAP, Secretary Pompeo, it's many, many US and global organizations that are finally joining in chorus to tell the PRC that they need to adapt and change and accommodate our real interests and concerns. And we're well on our way. But I give credit again to Stanford, Hoover, to all of you for doing that, for being strong partners in all of this. So again, thank you for the opportunity. Look forward to working with you even more.
Great. Well, I thank you, Assistant Secretary Stilwell, once again for these cogent and compelling remarks. We're just a few days away from the most sacred exercise in any democracy, which is a national election. And whether we have another second Trump administration or a return and rotation of power. Either way, I hope that the important innovations and really, I think, historic steps toward a U.S.-China relationship based on principles of cognizance, as you said, constructive vigilance, and reciprocity will endure as guiding principles in American foreign policy. I'd like to thank you for your remarks today. Thanks, Secretary Pompeo, for lending you to us for this hour and 15 minutes. Thank our audience and C-SPAN for joining us. Thank Orville Schell and Oriana Mastro for their remarks. Thank the Center for U.S.-China Relations at Asia Society and our staff at the Hoover Institution. And wish you all a good weekend, and Assistant Secretary Stilwell, a safe return to the United States. Thank you all so much.